Are you trying to tell me that Fahrenheit 451 came out 40?
Can you believe it? 40 years ago, this week, I got the job of writing Moby Dick for the screen from John Huston, so that was quite a month for me. And I was making $100 a week when I made it, and all of a sudden I was going to make $600 a week and go to live in Ireland. So all my life turned around completely that month. Yeah.
Well, it's hard for me to believe it because as we talked just before the tape began rolling, I was a teenager and I bought a copy of Fahrenheit 451, and I had no idea what I'd be doing in 40 years. I had no idea whatsoever. I thought, if I had dreamed 40 years ago that I would be sitting here talking to you about a book that I read as an adolescent, I would not have believed it.
Well, sometimes it's spooky the way things turn out. I was looking through my high school yearbook a couple of months ago, and I'd forgotten what I'd written for myself under my picture, and it read, "Headed for Literary Distinction." I was 17 when I predicted that for myself. And I've done fairly well with the prediction, yeah.
You sure have.
Yeah.
These other paperbacks, the Martian Chronicles and the Illustrated Man, of course, when I was a kid, I was a vociferous reader.
Yep.
And my mother always used to say, "Don, all you do is read science fiction. That's all you ever read, science fiction." That wasn't true, of course. But like most adolescent boys, I was hooked on science fiction.
Oh, sure.
Until I read these early Ray Bradburys. Mm. And they transcended science fiction because you have a literary mind. And I remember reading The Illustrated Man. I was in Toledo, Ohio. And my neighbor, or a boy who went to school with me down the street, also loved science fiction. And I read The Illustrated Man, and I was overwhelmed by it. I just loved it, and I raced down the block, and I said, Charlie, you've got to read The Illustrated. This is the most beautiful book. You've got to read it. So he read it the following week, and he said, "It's not so good."
There are always those. Well, I have experiences, two kinds of experiences that you remind me. I was in the airport 2 years ago going to London, and a woman passed and looked at me, and she came up. She says, "Are you some sort of writer or other?" I said, "Yeah." She says, "What's your name?" I said, "Ray Bradbury." She said, "Be still, my beating heart." And then I got to London. I moved into the Brown's Hotel, and a young bell captain took my luggage up to my room. He was around 17. And when we got in the room, he put my luggage down. He said, "Mr. Bradbury, are you a fairly well-known writer?" I said, "Well, I think so." He said, "You know, I've been asking around the hotel all day today, down in the kitchen and out in front at the desk and the doorkeeper, and no one seems to know who you are." And he went to the door and he turned, and he says, "But don't worry, your secret's safe with me." So you get those two experiences.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Fahrenheit 451. We chatted about it a little bit last year when you were here on the occasion of your Irish book. I think Fahrenheit 451 has turned into the perhaps your most significant novel. And many people put it on a par with Brave New World and Animal Farm and 1984.
Sure. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting how this came about, because it came about in two ways, as I recall. One, I believe you were walking down the street and stopped by the police.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Kind of give me some background about
how. Well, I was walking with a friend. This is around 1949, and this police car pulled up. Policeman got up and walked over and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Putting one foot in front of the other," which was a real smart-ass thing to say. And that didn't please the policeman, and I said, "Look, the logic here is completely wrong. Why would you question two pedestrians? They couldn't possibly be criminals. The way you are a criminal today is in a car, and you drive up, and you go in and burgle the joint, and you come out and drive away. You wouldn't call attention to yourself by walking." Well, he considered the logic of that, and finally admitted maybe I had a point, and he went on his way. So no big altercation or anything. But I was upset by the event and went home and wrote the story, The Pedestrian, about a future where people are not allowed to walk and got to stay in and watch their TV set. A variation on what Orwell did around that same time in 1984. And then 6 months or 8 months later, I took the pedestrian out for another stroll, and just to see what would happen. I often do this with my stories. And he turned a corner, and there's a young girl standing in the middle of the sidewalk. She takes a deep breath, sniffs his uniform. She says, "Kerosene, I know who you are. You're Mr. Montag, the fireman, the man who burns books." And 9 days later, the novel was finished. Thank God for these surprises.
But it was actually a novella, wasn't it? It was the fireman?
It was a short novella, 25,000 words, and it got a fair amount of attention.
I read that because as you know, I was a science fiction fan, and I had collected the Galaxy science fiction
there
from
you go.
Inception.
Yeah.
And I still have all of those Galaxies.
Yeah.
I have a complete run of them from the beginning through the early 1960s, and a complete run of fantasy and science fiction, and Astounding from 1945-46. So I remember that story.
Yeah, sure.
But it didn't remain a story in a magazine.
No, time passed, and the Un-American Activities Committee, of course, started their meetings in 48-49 with Parnell Thomas, and then later along came McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy with the House Un-American Activities, questioning people, and more and more irritation. And finally, Ballantyne came to me, and they said, "We love this novella of yours. Do you think you could make it a bit longer, and we'll make it the first publication of a soft cover and hard cover on the same day next year?" And I said, "I don't know. Let's see." And I sat down and discovered that all my characters had something more to say, and you let them step forward, and they say it, you know, and they predict the future for you just by speaking. And then when I did the play version of it later, the characters had even more to say. Beatty, the fireman, the fire chief, gives his reasons for burning books. That's not in the original novel. And it turns out, I didn't know myself, but Beatty said he was a failed romantic. He was a madman at reading books just like you were and just like I was at a certain age. And you run down the street, as you say, with a book, and you tell your best friend, "My God, you got to read this, it's the greatest." And then the next year, it's another book, and maybe the original book stays in your mind, in your hand, in your library. But we all have fevers, and we all think certain books at certain times can save our lives. It could be the Bible, it could be the Quran, it could be the Scientology for some people. And but we all run amok at a certain age, and Beatty was one of those. He thought books could do everything for him, He was so madly in love with him. And then his mother died of cancer, his father committed suicide, his girlfriend left him. All sorts of things happened, and he took it out on the books because they couldn't help him. He went back to the books, and they couldn't give him reasons for the cancer. They couldn't help him with the suicide of the father. And books can only help you up to a point, Just as friends can only help you up to a point. They can commiserate with you, but you finally have to make yourself well, The books can't make you well. They can make you partly well. Friends can do the same. So since he couldn't make himself well with the books, he turned on them and became a fire chief and burned them. And I didn't know that when I wrote the original book.
I remember seeing at a neighbor's television set, because my father in the 1950s was holding out for color, the Army McCarthy hearings.
Yes.
And I was a kid. I didn't know what they were. I came from a conservative Middle Western family anyway, and there didn't seem to be much concern about McCarthy in my neighborhood in those days. But apparently you were concerned about it enough that this, to a degree, was an impetus.
And I discovered early on, I was a liberal Democrat, and I worked for Adlai Stevenson twice, and later on I worked for Kennedy. But I found out that among all of my liberal friends, they were all cowards. They criticized the conservatives, but they never did anything about McCarthy. And I went to hear Adlai Stevenson in his first speech running for the presidency in 1952, and we walked out of the meeting, my wife and friends and myself, and they said, "What did you think of him?" And I said, "Okay, but something's missing." They said, "What?" I said, "He didn't mention McCarthy. Someone's got to speak up. And if the liberals don't do it, where are we going to be?" So I had my doubts, but I worked for him, and I voted for him. And then along the way, the campaign later that year, 52, was a pretty dirty one on all sides, but mainly from the Republican side, with Jew baiting and Catholic smearing and communists, this and that. And 4 days after the election, I was so enraged by the whole thing that I took an ad addressed to the Republican Party and saying, stop this, you know, stop all the insults and all the dirt, because if you don't, next election, we're going to vote you out. That's all I said, really, you know. And I went to visit my liberal, left-leaning liberal agent. He refused to speak to me. He wouldn't back me up. He slammed the door in my face. So I learned not to trust my liberal friends. It had to be just me speaking up against McCarthy. And I went to a meeting at the Crystal Room of the Beverly Hills Hotel. I think it was that same year. And there was a we were supposed to pass a resolution to give the right to the producers of films to take our names off of screenplays if we refuse to talk to the House Un-American Activities Committee. Well, you know, you can't do that. You can't give them that power. And so we took a vote one night at the Crystal Room. There were 1,000 writers there, all liberal, huh? All my liberal friends and myself. And we stood together. We took a silent ballot and we said, no, sir, we won't give in to the producers. We won't give them the right to take our names off screenplays. Well, I felt so proud of all my liberal friends, okay? And 2 minutes later, Borden Chase, who was the president of the Guild, leapt to his feet and said, take the vote over. The Hearst papers are going to screw us tomorrow morning. They're going to think we're all communists and all red lovers, what have you. And we can't. We've got to vote in favor of the producers to let them take our names off the screenplays. I demand another vote, this time a voice vote, not a secret ballot. Against the law, totally against the law, all my liberal friends gave in. They voted and they changed their vote. So this time it was 1,000 votes in favor of giving the producers that power. And I was left alone standing with Leon Uris and 10 other writers in the middle of the floor wanting to throw up. And I turned on the whole crowd and I said, shame. I said, where is your vote now? And Borden Chase pointed his finger at me and said, throw that man out. And I said, no, I'll throw myself out. And I won't come back for a long time. I'm ashamed of all of you. So I was the only liberal, along with Leon Uris and 10 others, who stood up that night. And I learned a valuable lesson. Don't depend on anyone. Huh? You go your own way. And if you can get people to follow you, swell. But otherwise, take the chance. And my agent said, well, you'll never work in Hollywood again. I said, that's not the way it works. I believe in the system. I believe that democracy works. I believe that I will work next year. And sure enough, I got the job of writing Moby Dick. And I said to my liberal agent, how's that, huh? And he hated it, huh? Because I'd proven him wrong.
Have you ever checked your FBI file, Ray?
Oh, I don't care, because there can't be anything there. You can't make up truths about people.
Oh, they have, though.
Well, yeah, but not with me. And if they did, they'd be in big trouble. See, I believe in... I don't get scared. I get angry. And I'm a real enemy if you lie about me. And if the FBI has anything like that, which I doubt, there's nothing to find, you see.
But a lot of people were angry at McCarthy, and a lot of people did indeed lose their jobs and were smeared.
Well, they didn't know how to defend themselves. They should have taken the Fifth, and some of them didn't. One of the Hollywood Ten came to me in that same period, I think maybe the next year, and he couldn't work. I think he'd been in jail for 6 months or 8 months, whatever it was. And he called me on the phone, and I didn't know him. Never met him in my life. I knew his name. He says, will you have drinks with me this afternoon? I said, yes, I will. And I met him at a hotel nearby, and he brought a screenplay with him. He says, I want you to help me sell this screenplay. I have a family I need to support. I said, sure. What do you want me to do? He says, put your name on the screenplay and sell it. I said, what? He said, yeah, and I'll give you 50% of the money. You can keep 50%. I said, I can't do that. It's not my screenplay. It's yours. And I wouldn't take, if I did sell it, I wouldn't take any money. I'm going to help you sell it, huh? So I said, this is a bad situation. Now, tomorrow night is a meeting of the Writers Guild. Huh? Will you come with me to the meeting, and I'll stand on the floor. I will defend you. I will help you sell the screenplay. Wouldn't do it. Wouldn't do it. I said, how can I help you if you won't help yourself? I said, I don't even know you. I don't owe anything to you. but I'm going to go stick my neck out tomorrow night at the annual meeting. Wouldn't come. And finally, in frustration, I said, what's the one thing that you hate most about McCarthy? He thought for a moment. He says, he lies. I said, aha, what are you asking me to do? Huh? You're asking me to lie for you, and I won't do it. I won't put my name on the screenplay. And I can't help you if you don't want to tell the truth to me. So they were their own enemies. They didn't cooperate with the truth. Huh? When I was offering my services, and I finally said, hey, you know, you deserve what you're getting because you've gotten in your own way. Why didn't you take an ad addressed to the American people and tell them the truth and say, we'll tell you, the people, but we won't tell the Un-American Activities Committee. You would have got all the American people on your side. Believe me, you would. And all they want to know is find out what in hell was going on. And they never found out. Very strange time. But I predicted that McCarthy would vanish when two people attacked him. And Edward R. Murrow was the first, and the lawyer was the second at the Army trials. And he blew away in the wind.
Book burning, of course, has been associated with fascist regimes, and we think of...
And communists. Yeah, Red China, well, 80 yes, million books burned, and 80 million people with them. Yeah.
And, of course, we know from the McCarthy era, there was a great deal of book banning, too, from United States Information Agency offices and this sort of thing. But things are better now, aren't they, in terms of censorship?
And they weren't that bad then.
They weren't?
Truman didn't do anything about McCarthy or the Un-American activities, and but Eisenhower did. When he became president, he said, put the books back on the shelf. Huh? That's all he had to say. And they went back on the shelves again. And it's very strange, these combinations of things. But it happens in almost every country of the world. It's happening in Israel and Palestine in the last few years. They're not actually burning the books, but you can't buy them. You can't buy Palestinian books over in Israel, and you can't buy Israeli books over in Palestine. And look what's happening in Yugoslavia. I'll just bet you can't find books on either side about the opposite side. It's part of the nature of man the last 3,000 years or so to do these things. And we're lucky here because we live in a society that's so multitudinous with so many groups. There's no way of your getting away with banning Mark Twain here or, something of mine there. Yeah, what the heck?
But there are feeble efforts, usually in local communities, school boards. They try, though.
They're very feeble, and they blow away quickly. I get mail all the time from teachers. A couple of months ago, there was some trouble with teaching something of mine in the school. And I said, when they want me to come defend them, I said, I won't do it. They said, why not? I said, because I will dignify these little frogs, these toads, and turn them into big frogs when I show up. And they'll strut around, and they're going to fight with me. And I said, I won't do that, because if you hold firm and put the books in the schoolroom, put them on the shelves again, these people are going to disappear. They always do.
I can't imagine anybody going after any of your books. I mean, they're essentially extremely wholesome books.
Well, I give you an example, several examples. An anthologist wanted to anthologize The Foghorn 10 years or so ago, and they went through, and they said, you've got some religious terms here we want you to take out. The godlight. The dinosaurs looking up at the godlight from the foghorn, from the lighthouse. And then I used the word God here or there once or twice. And I may have said, damn, someone exclaimed. And they said, we want you to take those out. I said, no way. I said, this is my story. And you want to publish the story? Leave it the way it is. Otherwise, give it back. And I won my point, and they published it. Yeah, but you have to be absolutely firm. And then an editor with one of the big publishing houses 12 years ago wanted to publish an anthology of 800 short stories. 800, think about that. I said, how are you going to do it? He says, oh, we're going to cut them down. Huh? We're going to edit them. So you got a lot of one-liners. And I'm going to read like Edgar Guest by the time you're done. And I said, you SOB. I said, you know what you are? He said, what? I said, you're a book burner. There's all kinds of ways of burning books, by destroying the mind of the book, by destroying the wisdom, huh? By taking out the truth, whatever is in that short story that makes it true. Huh? And I said, I'm going to get your job. I'm going to get you fired. And I was just furious. So I wrote to the publisher. I said, get this guy out and don't let him do that book, because he's going to destroy 800 authors at once, huh? Well, I didn't hear anything from anyone. And a year later, I was in Chicago, went in Brentano's bookstore, and this little book clerk ran up to me. She said, oh, Mr. Bradbury, you're so wonderful. I said, what did I do? She said, you got that SOB fired. I said, what SOB? She said, the guy that wanted to do 800 stories in an anthology. So you see, you've got to be active instantly. You can't give them an inch. It's like graffiti. As soon as it goes up, 10 seconds later, you rub it out.
Well, Fahrenheit 451 is a cautionary tale that really has helped to give us a lot to think about with regard to book burning. Isn't that true? And it's interesting that in this society that you have created, where books are not allowed, a group of people materialize who actually carry books in their heads.
That's right.
They become walking books.
That's right. And the lesson I teach, though, that's even more important, is don't be afraid of Big Brother, be afraid of Little Sister. See, the totalitarian societies in the past control from the top. Today, we have a lot of little groups around the bottom, you see, the Little Sisters, who don't want you to write about this, or a women's lib, or abortion, or non-abortion, or blacks, or whites, or browns, or whatever. And you can't listen to them. You just can't listen to them. And because if each one takes a book out of the library is empty. So you got to leave everything in the library and learn from it. But we've had then this, we don't have to burn books because we're not teaching reading in the schools. We've got to go back and question the teachers. We have to test immediately, not next year, in the next month, which we're not going to do, all the first grade teachers in the United States. And if they're not teaching reading, which they're not, give them 1 year to pull up their socks. At the end of a year, you test the teachers, and they don't want that. Huh? They don't want to be tested. And if they're not teaching reading, they get fired and you bring in new teachers, because you cannot give that responsibility to the second, third, and fourth grade teachers to do the teaching reading. That's not their job. They're there to teach you knowledge. Huh? And they resent it that the first grade teacher is passing the students up to them. And they come out of, hell, a lot of students come out of high school not knowing how to read today. That's criminal. That's criminal. And no one wants to talk about it.
What do you think about this group of ardent feminists? I think they are composed of people like Andrea Dworkin, Catherine, I think her name is McKinnon. These are women who believe that pornography is degrading to women and would seek to stop it. This is rather worrisome, too, because you're torn in two different ways. I'm not sure that pornography is necessarily demeaning to women any more than it is to men.
Well, they don't have to read it. It's not for them anyway. The male animal and the female animal are two different things. And this has been going on for centuries, the battle of the sexes. Women don't understand the needs of men and never will. And men don't understand the needs of women. And what we need is to find ways of getting together rather than separating. I think Playboy is one of the greatest things that ever happened in the world, because when I was 14, I knew nothing about sex. We had a civilization in the United States that didn't teach us anything. Nothing. Nil. I came back from a year out west when I was 13. I lived on a ranch. I found out about sex from the animals, okay? I came back to Waukegan, Illinois, and told my friends what I discovered about the birth of babies, huh? And I got thrown out of my best friend's house. The mother denied everything that I said, and I wasn't allowed to see my friends ever again. So that's the way it used to be. And this generation doesn't know, and you're just enough younger than myself, so you wouldn't recall either, huh? But there were no magazines that you could buy for an outlet, because you're not getting any outlet with people. You're having nothing to do with girls or women. I had my first love affair when I was 20. God, that's late, huh? 6 years before I had discovered at the age of 14 what sex is all about. Then you have to wait 6 years? Huh? So Playboy, I think, is a great thing. People don't have to look at it. And it happens to be one of the best magazines ever published anywhere in the world. They've published every major author from every country. They've interviewed every important politician, author, scientist, you name it, and done all the artwork by all the greatest artists. They never get credit for all the quality things they do. And along with that, all those wonderful naked ladies, huh, that we all dearly love, and we don't want to admit it, but they're great. I started out with a petty girl. And if, I don't think you're too young for that, but it was in Esquire magazine when I was in high school.
Sure. Well, I'm not far removed from your generation, and I remember driving through the Middle West with my family, and we stopped at a gasoline station and went into the men's room, and there was a machine on the wall, and it said 25 cents for the prevention of disease only. So I turned to my father and said, Dad, what is that?
Yeah.
And my father said, I'll tell you later.
Yeah.
Well, my father died earlier this year. He had yet to tell me what that machine
was. Yeah,
they
yeah.
They wouldn't do it.
No, no. My father and mother never talked about anything. And you find out all the other things. So this generation is benefited by information, but I think we've gone too far in the other direction, of course.
Too far?
Well, in other words, we give condoms to guys that were supposedly were going to give them to people in the fifth grade, which is ridiculous, of course. And then we tell them not to use them. Make up your mind. What are you going to do? And you've got all this sex education in school, but it doesn't seem to be benefiting anyone. There's more disease. There's more pregnancies. I don't know what the answer is. We Americans like to have answers to everything. We like to solve everything. And I don't know. The next thing for us to do to cut down on the pregnancies, to cut down on the disease. Do you have any ideas? I certainly don't.
Yeah. No, I don't, but I wonder if making schools responsible for giving condoms, and I'm not sure that's their job. They're educators.
That's right.
You know, you might want to have the health department do it or something like that, but why put the burden on the schools?
No, we did that in gymnasium class. There is always a lesson once a week for 16, 17-year-old boys on personal hygiene. And they ran pictures of people with syphilis, you know, and scared the hell out of you. This is 1937, 38. But that's about as far as the education got. They warned you about the diseases, but didn't tell you much else, very little else. Yeah.
Back to Fahrenheit 451. I remember your story you told me last year about being in the basement where you used coins to operate the typewriter to write the fireman, which later became the novel. But I, in preparation for my chat with you today, I wanted to see the film version, Truffaut's film version of Fahrenheit 451,
yeah,
which I'd seen quite a few years ago, and I just happened to have it on tape, so I watched it the other night. And I enjoyed the movie. I was just kind of struck by the selection of Oscar Werner, though, as Montag.
Mm-hmm.
That struck me as an odd choice.
Well, he was good, but again, if I were to criticize, when he took fire, he didn't take fire enough. When he fell in love with books. And that there should have been a tremendous change in his character. He got a little excitable, and he did a lot of things. But the film lacks a true dedication to the emotions that are supposed to be involved. And I want to do it over sometime in the next few years and do the whole book. And say to people, here's the screenplay. The novel's the screenplay.
Did you work on the screenplay?
No, I had turned it down. I should have done it, but I just finished a stage play, and I was exhausted, so I knew I couldn't do the screenplay. And so the film is beautiful. The ending, the last reel is fantastic. I cry every time I see it. Music, wonderful music by Bernard Herrmann. Wonderful photography, evocation of the woods and the people remembering the books. But see, the way to examine the emotional center, which is wrong, you'd have to go and look at Cosmos by Carl Sagan. He had a section in there 10 years ago, whenever it was, where he visits the library at Alexandria, and he's standing, they built this wonderful set, a miniature, and they put him in the middle of the miniature. And he looks around at all the papyruses, or papyri, and the scrolls, what have you. And you've got all these unknown works by Aeschylus and Plato and the Lucian, the great poets, the great playwrights. And there was a chance there, I kept saying to myself, Carl, run amok, run amok. Go and grab these papyri and unroll them and say, look, here is a dialogue by Plato no one's ever read, and here's something by Plautus over here, and something by Cicero over here, and they're gone, they were burned, and it's terrible, and make me cry, for God's sake, make me cry. And if I'd been doing that scene, I would have climbed those stacks like a monkey to show people the depth of my love for libraries. And he missed a chance there. That's what's missing from Fahrenheit 451, the movie.
You're right. There is very little passion. I also thought it was odd that Julie Christie played both roles.
Yeah.
What was the point of that?
That was a real mistake. It was an experiment, but it was doomed from the start because it got very confusing trying to figure out if this is the wife or this is the girlfriend. And she's the wrong age. It's got to be a 16-year-old girl or 15-year-old girl who is really naive and sappy, sappy. I've seen it on the stage many times now, and I saw it in Seattle, my musical version, my opera version, a couple of months ago, and they had the most beautiful young girl, about 16, who was so naive, you forgave her sappiness, see? If she's a little too old, you say, why is this older woman behaving like this, Why is she this romantic and this sappy? But a 15 or 16-year-old girl, he said, oh, God, I love her, and she's sure dumb, but I love her. And so that's what's missing if you have Julie Christie play that role when she's 25 or 30 or whatever it was. And anyway, I want to do it over. I hope to talk to Clint Eastwood and get him to direct it and play in it. He could play the fire chief. He could play Montag. He's a good director. I've only met him once in recent months. I saw him at a party, and I went up, and I said, I'm a fan. And he looked at me, and he says, I'm a fan, too. So who knows what's going to happen during the next
year. The book cries out to be remade.
Yeah,
the film didn't work as well as it should.
And in the meantime, there's going to be a rock opera in Prague, Czechoslovakia, on Fahrenheit 451 next year. And there's going to be a rock opera in London done by a member of Parliament, John Butcher. He's doing his version of Fahrenheit. There was a chamber opera in Australia a couple of months ago, and I've got my own version. So it's just one of those metaphors that's going to stick around. I didn't realize when I wrote it was going to be underfoot.
Well, it must give you a great deal of satisfaction to look back over this long, very distinguished literary career. And in a way, this 40th anniversary edition of Fahrenheit 451 kind of sums up the career, doesn't it?
Well, I'm very pleased. I feel spoiled. Sometimes I cry. I get up in the middle of the night, I look at my books there on the shelf, and I say, I can't believe it. You know, I've been very fortunate.
And I've been very fortunate, too, to be able to talk to you, Ray Bradbury. Thank you very, very much.